Blog Talk Radio. Hi, welcome. This is Amy Alcon, nationally syndicated advice columnist and host of this show, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Therapy and Research. Tonight's guest is therapist Dossie Easton. Now, she's pretty much the ethicist of interesting sexual arrangements, kind of a cross between John Stuart Mill and Miss Manners for people who want to get it on with more than one person. But if you aren't one of those people, stay with us because her ideas for people who want to expand out from monogamy also have a lot of wisdom for people who want to stay in it. Dossie is co-author with Janet W. Hardy of this great book, The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships, and Other Adventures. It's a book I've been recommending for years to people who ask me about sexually open relationships, whether they can handle one, how to handle them, all the questions they have. And hi, Dossie. You have reclaimed the word slut, and you reclaimed it before it was stylish and cool to reclaim the word slut. I love that.
Oh, thank you.
So talk about that.
Well, actually, I reclaimed the word slut in 1969 when I decided that I would never be monogamous again, which is a long time ago. How it became the title of the book was we were writing it, and people would say, what are you guys writing? And I started calling it The Ethical Slut, almost like a nickname. And then when it came time to put the title on the book, and we thought about, you know, polyamory in the new millennium or something, and it seemed like Ethical Slut was the right name for it. So we named it that, and I'm very proud to reclaim that word.
Well, because, go ahead.
Sorry.
No,
because
keep going.
Me,
I didn't mean to cut you off.
I have sort of chosen to define slut as a person, man or woman, who chooses to celebrate sexuality in whatever ways come across them. And, of course, paying attention to the fact that it's very important that we have certain ethics when we do that, that goes along with the territory.
How do you define the word slut?
Any person who celebrates sexuality in an adventurous manner, it could be with one partner, it could be with many, it could be with none. But there is an idea about celebrating. More commonly, it's any person who celebrates sexuality with more than one person.
I love this thing you wrote in the book, that it's a person of any gender who has the courage to lead life according to the radical proposition that sex is nice and pleasure is good for you. I mean, how do we not think that? How do so many people not think that?
Isn't that bizarre? That was the title I came up with my honors thesis I wrote for my bachelor's degree, actually. I defended it, right? And it's so hard for us to get through our thick skulls with all these years. We have so many messages that say sex is only okay if. Only okay if you're in love, only okay if you're married, only okay if you're planning babies, only okay, I don't know, you know. But it seems like people seem to need an only okay. And what we're saying is there is nothing wrong with sex. Sex is lovely. It's delightful. It's a good thing.
And now you find slut with ethics.
And I think that's pretty important because people tend to see sexually open people as unethical people.
Right. And the fact is that slut lifestyles are not sustainable unless you have very good ethics. If you are not aware and take into account everybody's feelings and everybody's boundaries and respect for everybody and honoring their choices, then after a while you won't have anybody willing to play with you, frankly. Riding roughshod over people is not my idea of a juicy kind of slut I want in my life, you know?
Right. Now, we have a question from the chat room from Radways. He says, how is that bizarre? I'm not sure what he says is bizarre, but when promiscuity spreads disease.
We consider that the practice of safer sex is very important for ethical sluts, that is one of the first places ethics goes, is to be very conscious about not spreading disease.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I think is really unique and important about your book, because I think for a lot of people, the ethics issue is such a big deal in this area, and you really, throughout the book, The Ethical Slut, which is just so great, you go through and you explain how to do this so people aren't hurt, they aren't horrible to each other, they aren't dishonest, and I think that's what makes this so helpful. It's also kind of a fun read. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. I love this. You said, we believe it's okay to have sex with anybody you love, and we believe in loving everybody.
So, that's actually a quote from A Flowered Child in 1967.
Oh, that's so great. And so, I mean, how does that play out in your own life?
How it plays out in my own life is that it makes it possible for me to have a whole lot of really wonderful relationships that are very different from one another. And I think in the world at large, often there's sort of almost no territory at all between a one-night stand and being coupled. And there's this vast area in the middle where you can have share sexuality with people that you love as friends, that you love as companions, that you love even in an infatuation, only that you know that infatuation will never lead to a joint checking account, right?
I love how you put that. I remember Nana and George O'Neill wrote in Open Marriage that you can't expect one person to fulfill all your hookup points, and that just reminded me of what you were just saying. That you know, you can't. It's such a lie that you can be totally fulfilled by one person.
And it puts, I think, an undue burden on a relationship. If I have a sexual desire, you know, what is my choice? I either be frustrated for the rest of my life, if my partner isn't interested in the same thing, I'm either frustrated for the rest of my life or I have to leave my partner. That doesn't make any sense. What makes sense is to say, okay, you don't want to do this or that, and I want to do it, so I'll go do that with somebody else. It's really not that different from saying you don't want to go backpacking, so I'll go backpacking with somebody else.
Right, it's sort of naked backpacking. But
yeah, right.
And now, this isn't to say, again, that open relationships are for everyone, but, you know, along with what you were saying, some of the saddest letters I get, they're usually from men. Their partner has decided, nope, I'm done with sex. And then, but you can't get it anywhere else. You can have it with me, but you can't get it elsewhere, which seems really a terrible thing to say to somebody you love.
Well, this is true, but we must understand that is for what I think of as kind of old-fashioned people, but for many people that is what their morals are. That we can't say that a wife or a husband has no right to say no to sex at any given time or forever, for that matter, with their spouse, or that they should get divorced because we don't know what their circumstance is. They may have young children, right? So what's sad is that there's such a huge rule that says that you're not allowed to get satisfaction somewhere else when everything works so much more smoothly. I've had couples in my practice who were so happy when certain kinds of sex or sexual adventuring was no longer an issue between them because they each could choose what they wanted to do, and then they chose what they did with each other. And many couples find that they had sex more and enjoyed it more and felt freer with their sexuality, and like their sexuality was a creative, you know, life-enhancing thing in their relationship after they opened the relationship.
Can you explain why that would be?
Well, it's different for different people. For some people, it takes the burden of got to satisfy everything off or got to be all things to this person I'm married to. And for other people, they find the adventure is kind of arousing and it brings more life to things.
Sort of like
some people like to hear about people are different this way. Some people choose not to hear about the explicit sexual details about what a partner may share with another person. Other people just love it and it's a turn on.
Yeah, I was going to say it's sort of like participating in porn as a turn on instead of watching it. You know, that's sort of the traditional thing that people say.
That's well said. I like that.
Thank you. Now, you actually think, you know, there's this don't ask, don't tell model, and you think that that actually creates problems for all involved, and I was very interested in that and wanted to know why.
Well, partly because there tends to be, I think some of the highest forms of polyamory wind up forming kind of tribes or groups or neighborhood, sort of non-geographical neighborhoods or something like that, extended families. And this is, to me, some of the most positive things that could happen about open relationships. I was doing a workshop here in Marin, and some of the people said, oh, but we have young children. How could we ever do this? And I said, well, then, you know, clearly you ought to have your affairs with other people that have young children, and then some of you could babysit one time, and some of you could babysit another time, and the children would have sleepovers and, you know, wonderful sort of cousins or whatever you want to call them. It's great. It works really great.
Right. Well, it's not appropriate to tell your kids anyway, you know, I'm going to go over and get it on with, you know, the guy next door. You wouldn't tell them that if you were having an affair either, you know, and that's where I think people get a little unrealistic with that.
Well, but the point is, whatever you choose to tell your kids, if you tell the kids that, you know, you're going to get a neat sleepover with Susie and Johnny and
right.
Susie's mom will be babysitting, will be, you know, doing it, and the rest of us are going somewhere else,
right.
You know, it's like what, you know, you don't have to tell the kids where you're
right.
going or what you're going to do when you get there.
Mommy's going to get spanked by the next door neighbor tonight. Mommy was a bad girl. And now you and Janet, your co-author, you say that you prefer to meet your partner's partners.
Yes, absolutely, because what happens is if when there's an outside partner I haven't met, it's very easy to imagine that person is younger and thinner and richer and smarter than me, right? It's real easy to imagine that that person is everything that I wish I was and no, I'm not. Or, you know, has lost that 20 pounds I'm thinking about losing and, you know, whatever, right? And when I meet a person, that's a real person. And because our connection is almost by definition, even by having a lover in common, there's an intimacy in that. And so we tend to be, if we can get past the societal myth that we are supposed to be in competition, a script that I just don't like to play out, I see no reason for it, then we're in a great position to actually like each other, feel compassionate with each other, and care about each other's feelings.
Yeah, I think that it's a very different view than most people have. I want to do a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life, with the help of the top brains from psychology and research. Tonight's brain belongs to therapist Dossie Easton. She is co-author of The Ethical Slut, a terrific book I've been recommending for years to people who ask me about sexually open relationships. And tonight's show even has wisdom for people who don't want an open relationship, just want some real wisdom, real different thinking on relationships, very wise thinking. So stick around for the rest of an interesting hour, and you can call in to comment, ask for advice, ask a question. You can, even if you disagree with what we're saying, 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. Dossie, you write that the slut economy contrasts the starvation economy, and you have this great quote, sluts share their sexuality the way philanthropists share their money, because they have a lot of it to share, because it makes them happy to share it, because sharing makes the world a better place. So can you tell us about the starvation economy versus the slut economy?
Well, a lot of people, the starvation economy comes from a place where people sort of believe, maybe they learned this as children, I don't know, but they believe that there are finite amounts of attention and love and sex and good feelings and security and so on. And so if somebody else gets some, I'm somehow losing. I get less. That's the starvation economy model. There's not enough to go around, a real belief. Well, the truth is that passion, desire, love, affection, and sex, or at least sexual desire, are not finite qualities. There's plenty of it. The things that are finite is time management becomes a big issue. But,
right.
but beyond that, you know, a mother can love several children. I can love several lovers. It's not like I'm going to run out of love.
Well, why do we believe we only can have one person, that special someone? We say that special someone, not that special few someones or the special crowd or herd or something like that. Why is that?
That's a very long political question.
Okay.
But let's put it this way. Most people nowadays are no longer getting married, at least people sort of, I can't even say most Americans, but I don't know how to say this, but maybe most middle-class Americans aren't really planning on getting married as virgins and staying married to the same person for the rest of their life. A lot of people would like to, but the truth of the matter is that most of us can expect to go through more than one primary relationship in our lifetime, possibly three or four, in a pattern that has been called serial monogamy, which I would point out is another form of polyamory. So the idea, the thing that I find that we need to rethink is this notion that when, therefore, a relationship, the kinds of relationships that we're having in the modern world for emotional security and not so much based on financial security, the commitment is different. The commitment to a marriage used to be we stay together and work the farm or the children will starve
right.
and no one will feed us when we're old. That's no longer the case. And even the people who argue one man and one woman, right, to raise children, actually, in agrarian cultures, all able-bodied people work in the fields and the children are raised by their grandparents.
Right. And my mother, she's been studying the Bible for about 40 years as literature, and I know from going mm-hmm. with her to her class, the thing is filled with polygamy. They all had a bunch of wives, or the rich people had a bunch of wives, you know, and it's interesting
mm-hmm.
because, you know, so much, you know, of our so many of our negative views on sex, I think, come out of religion, where, you know, if you look to the Bible, I mean, if we imitated them, you know, the guy next door would have, you know, Mary, Betty, Francis, you know, and maybe a few more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's a lovely book out that, I know the people who were...
Uh-oh, we've just lost Dossie. Let's see, we're having some problems. Greg, I need Greg to call Dossie. Hopefully Dossie will call back. Let's see, I'm going to get Dossie's phone number. Okay, give it to Greg. Just bear with me for a minute. We're going to get her right back. Everybody just hang on with us. I think she'll just call right back. Let's see. Hopefully she knows she's been dropped. If any of you have questions, you can feel free to call in or ask in the chat room. We're talking with Dossie Easton. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the help of the top brains from psychology and research. Tonight's brain belongs to therapist Dossie Easton, and she is pretty much the ethicist of interesting sexual arrangements. I keep saying social arrangements. She's the author of The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships, and Other Adventures. This is a terrific book I've been recommending for years to people who ask me about sexually open relationships, whether they can handle them, how they can handle them, all the questions they have. And tonight's show has wisdom even for people who aren't looking to have an open relationship. So stick around for the rest of a very interesting hour. You can call in to comment, to ask for advice, or to ask a question. It looks like Dossie's back. Dossie, you're back.
I'm back,
for
yeah.
a moment.
Yeah, I know. But here I am again.
Oh, good. Okay. So I wanted to ask you next. Let's see. I lost my train of thought a little bit. So you say that you hate monogamy, and you sort of laid out some ideas about that. You know, why do you hate monogamy?
Okay. Hate monogamy in the sense of that I don't want to do it.
Okay.
I don't actually hate monogamy. I think a lot of people have chosen monogamy, and when it is a free choice, a choice among all the options that are out there, something that people are doing because they want to and not because they think they're supposed to, then I think it's a fine thing, and why not? I think that's great. I've been monogamous for periods of my life and enjoyed it enormously. So I don't hate monogamy in that sense. For me personally, opening up my life to multiple lovers started basically in my feminism. I didn't want to be anybody's territory anymore.
You also have a very interesting comment. You took some time off from relationships. I read that. You know,
that's
that,
right. When I left my last monogamous relationship, I actually was pregnant when I left, so it was kind of an obvious time to take time off. But there was about 5 months of celibacy in there, which is unusual for me. And And then after that was when I had my kind of vision that I really wanted to change my life and do something different. My daughter was a baby, 3 months old at the time, and that was back in 1969.
And I think that relationship timeout, that's one of those things that I found in your book that I think is helpful for people, even people who don't want to have a sexually open relationship. You know, people don't think about doing that, you know, consciously. They might have time between partners, but to take time off to become who they're going to become, or think about where they, what they need to work on, you know, based on how the last relationship didn't work. People are, you know, so often trying to basically live themselves in the arms of another, and I think that is a really sad strategy.
Right. I actually at that time decided that I would have relationships but not get partnered for 5 years.
Oh, right. I remember.
Yeah. I needed to find out who I was when I wasn't trying to be somebody's wife.
Right,
and especially
women do that a lot. They, you know, they think I'm going to become the person who's with this guy, and he's a big guy and has this big job. They will often partner up with guys. I know that you're with women, but they will partner with guys, and maybe lesbians do it too, who are, you know, the person that they want to be. It's sort of an idealistic thing, and it's not about partnering with somebody in a true partnership.
Right. Well, back in the 60s, it was very early in feminism. It was very radical for a woman to be living a life, you know, kind of with her own agency and to have her own destiny. And part of one of the problems I wanted to address is I had been kind of told that being intelligent and creative and thoughtful and philosophical and having opinions and ideas and stuff was unwomanly. And I needed to be a human, you know.
Now, you write, you know, that jealousy is the biggest boundary to doing this. And so, but you also point out, I love this, that monogamy isn't a cure for it.
Right.
Go ahead.
I think one of the first things people need to look at is if they are in a monogamous relationship and they still feel jealousy, what in heaven's name is that feeling? What's going on? What does it mean? What does it mean about how they feel safe and secure in the world or in their relationships? And maybe if they dig into that, they'll find something that is very useful to them. When I looked at my jealousy when I first decided to open my life and that I would never be monogamous again, I noticed that I was massively insecure, that I had been taught that the only security I could really have in the world was the exclusive erotic attention of some man, hopefully of decent status or something, but, you know, who cared about nobody but me. And I thought, how am I going to have a sense of security that is mine, that I own and operate? I can't have my security be contingent on somebody else, especially not on something as silly as somebody else desiring nobody but me. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, see, I find these views of yours, for somebody who doesn't want to have an open relationship, very personally empowering. And one thing that I love that you do in this book, The Ethical Slut, and I'm talking with therapist Dossie Easton about the wonderful book she co-authored, The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships, and Other Adventures. You can find her website at DossieEaston.com. It's DossieEaston.com. So you dig into your own jealousy and you really explore it and you don't just try to shove it away, you know, and I think that it's much healthier than the trying to shove it away, what you did. Can you talk about how you dealt with some of your episodes of this serious, really big jealousy?
Mostly by taking care of myself. I say treat it like the flu, you know. Once I got to make sense with things, it's kind of like look around and say, okay, how am I going to take care of myself? Because what am I going to do? Call my partner up who's out on a date with somebody else and shriek at them that they have to come home because I'm feeling insecure? I mean, that just really is bad poly form. bad form, yes. So then what I look at is say, okay, what do I need and what can I do to fulfill some of my own needs? And is there something in my life that I need in the longer term that I need to be looking at? For some people, that might be looking for another lover of my own. But it might also be looking for more friends, or it might be looking for connections of various sorts, or it might be looking for, you know, a place to go do art. I don't know. You know, it could be anything. But to say, what is this hole in my life, and how do I fill it? And what am I going to fill it with? That leaves me in a place of huge choice, because there's a lot of different things that might fill that hole. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me. I've always had the idea that relationships end, and I'm easily bored. Greg, my boyfriend and my producer, he's endlessly interesting. So we've been together almost 10 years. I can't see ever being without him. But I think that many people find this very threatening, the idea, like you're saying, that they're your home and your partner's off with somebody else. They think that's horrible, and they could never deal with that kind of that kind of feeling. Whereas, you know, as I said, I know relationships end. Is that what it takes to be able to manage this? Or for some people, is it just too much, this sort of threatening, horrible feeling?
Jealousy can be, it actually isn't an emotion. It's a set of emotions. Different people have experienced it in very different ways. Me, I feel insecure. A lot of people do. Other people may feel angry or territorial. Other people may feel hurt. Other people may be frightened. Other people may feel guilty. I was raised Roman Catholic. I can feel guilty about just about anything. Somebody else might, you know, decide I'm not desirable anymore. I should lose 20 pounds, you know, back to the body image thing or whatever. But people experience it in a lot of different ways. The only thing that sexual jealousy has in common is the stimulus of saying, of looking at saying my partner desires somebody in addition to me.
Well, we talked before about the primary relationship, and I think that's something, I know that from having read Nan O'Neill and some other stuff, but can you talk about, you know, how that works? You have a primary relationship, and then you have other partners, and of course, you could end up falling in love with one of those other partners and want to ditch your primary person, but the primary relationship is sort of your base, right?
Well, you know, you can fall in love with another person and not ditch your primary partner.
Good point.
Why would you have to leave your partner, your primary partner, because you fall in love with somebody else? That doesn't make any sense. People fall in love all the time, and it doesn't necessarily last very long either.
Or it's not appropriate. They might fall in love with someone who's with somebody else, and they don't have an open relationship, and that's not going to work, or they're unavailable for some reason. They're on another continent or something. So, but that's sort of an expected way that people think. So if they understand that, if they can open things up in that way, I think that that might maybe make them feel more secure. But again, some people just can't deal with this.
In many ways, it does. I think that polyamory makes people more secure because if you fall in love with somebody else, you don't have to leave your partner.
Right.
That's like the big point. Partnerships over long term. There's a lovely book by Esther Perel that I recommend to everybody called Mating in Captivity.
Yes, it's a good book.
Yeah. About the fact that the difficult fact that long-term relationships sexually can become less than fantastically arousing when you've been together for lo these many years. And the book Mating in Captivity is a wonderful sort of way to run through all the different things you can do to go to work on that problem. That's what I tell my clients who are dealing with sexual boredom, you know, to say, well, the truth is that in a loving relationship, it doesn't mean your love has died. What it means is that you've been having sex together for a really long time and you counted on passion to drive that, and now, that just doesn't turn on hot like hot and cold running water, you know. Now you have to actually make an effort to find your turn on. That's not a problem. There's a thousand ways you can find your turn on and make an effort to do it. You just have to do it on purpose. You can't just sort of hope it comes along and does it to you. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. And I think, I mean, the stuff that you emphasize about personal security, I think that when you're personally secure, I think that a big part of that, when you don't need that other person to feel whole, when you don't need the relationship to feel whole, like you took those 5 years off to become the full person that you are, I think that especially for women, I think that that's a really great thing to do. And, you know, if you can get off the sort of, you've got to have marry one person and have sex with them, and you can actually feel better about hooking up. You know, that's actually I see as a it's a healthy thing. I think, you know, there's such, you know, it's sort of lamenting that, you know, oh, they're hooking up on campus, and I think, well, when they're ready for a relationship, they'll get one.
Yeah,
and maybe that's a good thing. You know, they're doing what they want, what works for them.
I was quite surprised because, you know, I'm 68 years old, so I come from a much older generation. And the world was very, very conservative when I grew up. I was a teenager in the 50s. And the world has changed a lot, and I'm very surprised to hear people say that they just assume that people will date in their sort of college age, perhaps, until they're ready to settle down, you know. But they assume that they're going to date several people. That wasn't the assumption when I was young. It's interesting that these things change.
Right. I know my mother, because we read her diary, which is just terrible, but my mother dated all these people. My mother was like the revolving door of men, but she talked about some guy kissed her, you know. It wasn't, they didn't get that intimate back in the 50s. It was just, you know, sort of, oh, got some tongue, probably something like that. My mother, I hope, won't listen to this show and be horrified. How do you make agreements to do this, to have an open relationship?
The first thing, if you're going to open an existing relationship that was presumed to be monogamous beforehand, and hopefully actually is, which is maybe it isn't, so some people have to get over that hurdle and come to some kind of acceptance. But presuming you both simply have decided that this would be a neat thing to do and there's not other clutter in the way, the first thing to do is to set up your first agreements, to take some risks and see what that feels like. A risk might be, for instance, going online with your partner on one of the dating sites like OkCupid and talking about who you find cute and what ads you might respond to.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful because, you know, as somebody who hasn't done this, you tend to see this as some kind of like, okay, now you're in bed with the guy down the block, you know, and it's great, these small steps. And actually, I should back up, and because I didn't ask you, how do you tell your partner that you'd like to open things up sexually?
Well, you just said it. That's how you tell them.
Well, is there a sample script? Because I know that people are very afraid of saying this and then have the partner say, turn it into some horrible fight that they never get over. And, you know,
the easiest script is to bring home a book like Ethical Slut.
Which is just
set it on the coffee table and say, oh, honey, I read this interesting book.
Right.
I do often advise couples to read the book a chapter at a time, say a chapter a week, and then get together for brunch on Saturday and talk about what they've read or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think that's
another
great
way
idea.
To get your toes in the water. Then people will make agreements, you know, maybe they'll actually go and have a coffee date and meet somebody from one of those ads, or maybe they have somebody in mind they want to ask out. And some couples actually meet prospective partners of their partner before any sexual engagement is allowed. So some couples actually, both of them decide if kind of vet a new lover, right? Does that make sense? Possibly
yeah,
all three
yeah.
of them, depending on how many people are in the primary relationship.
Yes, no, that makes sense. But now what happens when, you know, one person says, oh, I'd like to do this, and the other person says, absolutely not? Do you ever mediate those situations?
Yes, although there needs to be a respect for consent here, and I don't know what to do if there is such a huge difference. There are other huge differences that couples may have, okay? I'm in graduate school here, and you get offered a great job in Australia. That's a huge decision that couples may need to look at. I want to have babies, and you don't want to have babies. That's a deal breaker for a lot of people. So
right.
There are many. This isn't the only deal breaker that may come down the road.
And this is something I really love about your book, The Ethical Slut. You talk about consent being a very important hallmark of an agreement. This isn't a thing, you don't suggest that somebody bully their partner into doing this, even though you think it's a great idea for a relationship. This isn't something you get to shove your partner into and say, do this or else. That's not going to work.
Oh, Heavens no. We're talking here about going to work on all everything you ever learned about how sex was supposed to be in the world and changing that. That takes work. It takes a huge amount of emotional work. You're talking about going out into a unknown territory and writing entirely new scripts. This is a lot of effort has to go into this. And it's like anything else you want to change in yourself. If you got programmed by a lot of trauma, you may want to do some therapy to change that, or you may want to do some spiritual work to change that, or you may want to do some any kind of work to change that, right? If you got raised as a woman in a sexist culture, you may want to do some work to figure out what kind of a woman you actually want to be when you're free to be the kind you want to be. Similarly, to go into a polyamorous lifestyle requires a lot of work, a lot of willingness to kind of search your emotions and talk about them endlessly and be prepared to deal with these very complicated feelings that come up, be prepared to be afraid and step forward anyway. It's a big deal. So to ask someone to do that, to bully somebody into doing that, it's never going to work. You're never going to get a sustainable answer. Sustainable is an important word for me.
Talk about sustainable.
Well, I have one friend that I was primary partners with for 3 years that I still see. We broke up in 1979.
And so,
that's what
yeah,
I call sustainable.
That's sustainable. Yeah, it's
we are
very...
way more friends than lovers now, but that's a really long history, right? I have just... You know, my extended family, I take my security from my extended family of lovers, not just from one person, but from a whole bunch of people, from a sense of family. And a lot of those people are kind of, people that have sort of drifted apart maybe and are no longer actively lovers, or maybe we get together once every 3 or 4 years and have a really sexy date and with fond reminiscences, who knows, right? But the point is that you can have a security with people that care about you and that you care about that's really very expansive and very secure, because if one piece of it doesn't work at this moment in time, another part of it will work.
What's very interesting, too, when you talk about the stuff that you have to do within yourself to get comfortable with this, because this is not for us to say, okay, I'm going to get over my jealousy.
No, we have jealousy for evolutionary reasons, and that's not an easy thing.
And the funny thing is that, you know, people who have these sexually open relationships are thought to be immature, and maybe some of them are, but in order to do the stuff you're talking about, it seems to take an enormous amount of growth as a person. And you can't just sort of just go off and have sex with the guy next door. You have to, I keep using that, but you have to actually become a person who can do that, who can do that without hurting your partner. That's sort of amazing.
Yeah, they sometimes think that we're immature people who have no boundaries. Actually, the only way this works is if you have very, very sophisticated boundaries that you're very thoughtful about and very careful about, and you keep exploring and learning about, right?
What
because
are
the
some
other
of those?
Thing, I can have good boundaries, and then someone else may have different boundaries than mine. And
so you set up. Oh, sorry. You set up those boundaries. Yeah. How does that work? What are the boundaries, and how do you set them up?
Well, the boundaries are very individual because they have to do with what is the cost of not having the right boundary in place is usually an emotional cost of feeling really, really bad, of feeling freaked out, of feeling overwhelmed. And so what we have to learn is basically the boundary of coming into ownership of our own emotions and saying, well, if I'm freaking out here, what do I want to make of that? How do I want to understand that? What do I want to do? How do I want to take care of myself? Is there some healing I need to get into? What's going on inside me that I'm having such a huge, overwhelming emotional response to this? There's a lot of things that I have done that I was terrified to do. I trained myself in body image by going to nude beaches way back in the early 60s to kind of try to come to terms with myself and my own fear of being naked, because I'd been taught this terrible modesty and I wanted to change it.
I like how you put that terrible modesty.
Yes.
You seem to do, but actually what I really respect about you, I try to do this also in my life, that whatever you're afraid of, you think, okay, that's what I have to do. And that seems to be how you've lived your life.
Oh, yeah. I am aware that other people don't necessarily make that choice.
But actually, as you're saying,
cost of being a rather rebellious person in my youth is when you rebel, then you look at the things you're afraid of that you're sort of and see that that's part of what you've been programmed to be afraid of, what the society has told you you must be afraid of, and go, well, I'm not going to be afraid of that anymore, and deal with the problem. And it's a wonderful journey, frankly.
I agree with you. Actually, there's a kid's book about, I forget what it's called, Monster in My Closet, it's called. And the kid gets in bed with the monster, and I love that metaphor because I always find when you get in bed with the monster, which is sort of appropriate, the ethical slut, but hopefully you're not sleeping with monsters, you know, that the monster becomes much smaller. And that's what the kid finds, the monster in his closet. He's not scary. He's kind of cute. Once he gets intimate with the monster, and I mean, I look at all the things I'm afraid of. I was terrified to do this radio show. I mean, not with you, but in general, you know, I started doing it and, you know, I like to say I suck a lot less than I did like, you know, 6 months ago. And now I love doing it. At first it was terrifying, but it just gets smaller and smaller as you work out the kinks.
And what you're saying is also a useful way to look at it. Look at the things that aren't about sex in your life that you've been afraid of and that you conquered, right? I was afraid to go to graduate school. Now I'm a licensed professional.
Right.
I was afraid to write books, actually. Terrified.
No,
that's really scary.
Yeah, no, of writing. I'm terrified of, you know, that each week when I do my column, I've done a million advice columns, but every week I think, oh my God, what if it's not funny? What if I can't think of anything funny? What if I can't get this science right? I'm terrified, and I think it keeps you from being a hack, and I like that feeling, you know, and I try to, you have to always challenge yourself in that way, I think.
Mm-hmm. One of the good places of fear in our lives is that it challenges us and wakes us up and kind of drives us a little bit to take steps in the direction we want to grow in.
Right.
But the other thing about finding your path, actually, is one of the things that polyamory makes possible is to allow your desire to tell you something about what you might want to explore next.
How does it do that?
Well, if I find myself passionately attracted to somebody, maybe somebody who's different from who I'm usually attracted to, maybe somebody who's outside of my experience, maybe somebody from a different culture, maybe somebody of a different gender than who I usually connect with, whatever, right? Then it's like, oh, you know, curiosity is a very good thing. It kind of leads us to go down paths we might never have discovered. Because some of the people that I connect with in my wonderful life, they give me new experiences of new ways to be human, new ways to be in the world. When I was first in New York, I was fascinated. I was living in the Lower East Side, and there were 39 languages spoken on the Lower East Side at that time. And there were all these cultures around me, and they were fascinating. They had so many different ways of doing things, of communicating, of expressing feelings. You know, I came from this little monocultural town in New England that knew that they had the right way and all the other ways were the wrong way, right? And I was in New York and there was a world of many ways. So when I get attracted to something, I pay attention to that and go, oh, look, that's interesting. Much as I might pay attention if I become attracted to a different kind of music or decide I want to read a lot about some aspect of science or something, you know? It's like it enlarges me, it enriches me.
And I think that that's actually more necessary than ever because we live so long now. But now, by the same token, while you're talking about the excitement and everything that you can bring to your life by experiencing new things, you say that your experience, you know, with these polyamorous relationships is that you need some sort of predictability to deal with the stresses of open relationships.
Yeah. Partners who are living together, and for that matter, anybody, I mean, I take tremendous pride just to start with. I always do what I say I'm going to do. I know last week was a problem because I was sick and I blew it. But It's very important to me. If I have a date with one person and somebody else calls me up with tickets to Lady Gaga, you know, I'm still going to say, well, I don't know if I can say yes. I have to see if I can reschedule my date, because I'm not going to ask, and I'm going to ask that person if we can reschedule and not tell them how important it is, because who cares, you know? Because I said I was going to have a date with person X, and to run off with person Y is rude. It's bad manners.
Right.
So I do what I say I am going to do. It's very important. With a partner, mostly we have to know when we expect people to be around and when we expect them to be gone. If we have kids, we have to know who's babysitting and what's going on. That's even more important. And I think we have a right to kind of know what's coming down the pike. If we can talk easily about desire, about crushes people have, about fascinations people have, I'm thinking about, I just think that person over there is really hot. If we can talk about that without, you know, getting weak in the knees, then our lives become more predictable, because we can say, okay, so you're going to go check them out, right? You know, somebody comes back and says, actually, that person is drunk.
right. And another thing that people do have to be very signed up.
I mean, you could have some night that you're just not going to come home if you arrange in advance, but that you can't do that without making your partner feel secure about it. You know, like you're saying, the thing I love about your book, The Ethical Slut, is that you really talk about being a responsible slut. And I think that's very important for the other person to not be hurt.
Absolutely. To stay out overnight without telling your partner you're going to do that, all I can think of is back in the 70s for a while, the Highway Patrol had a number in the Bay Area, here where I am, San Francisco Bay Area. They had a number you could call if you thought somebody was missing and they might be in an accident or something, and they would tell you if the person you were looking for had wound up in a hospital or an emergency room or something like that, right? They lasted 3 months.
Right.
How many times have you wanted to call a number like that when somebody was late and you couldn't reach them?
Greg's going to kill me. I did. I couldn't reach him for a while in Detroit, and I called this is Detroit. I called the number there, and they said that they couldn't get out there for maybe a day and a half. And I said, well, why don't you just call the coroner then, have them come with a bag, you know? So that's Detroit, though. That's San Francisco. So he won't tell me. Greg,
we all get terribly
trouble.
Anxious when somebody is late. It's not right to make people suffer like that.
Right. I love that they couldn't come for a day and a half. It's called a wellness check. You know, it's like, he'll be decomposing by then. Thank you. Because you talk so much about ethics, you say, here's the thing. You say, people, you know, sometimes the relationship somebody has is already open. Just one partner doesn't know it yet, which we call cheating. And you don't advocate this.
No. But I do... I don't advocate cheating at all. I think it's really problematic. But I do know that it happens. And I think that the idea that what I believe and what I've experienced and what I've certainly worked with in my therapy office is that it is possible to get from cheating to a better place. That cheating does not mean the world comes to an end. It is not a good thing. It's not sustainable. It is destructive to the primary relationship. It's also destructive to whoever that other relationship is, because how many of us would like to be, you know, want to go on being somebody's dirty little secret, you know?
Yeah.
That's like saying that an outside partner has no rights, has no feelings of his or her own. But when there is cheating, there's a huge focus on they talk about therapy to repair trust after an affair, right? And I found out to my kind of shock and horror that many people think it's appropriate to have the offending party in the office, in the therapist's office with their spouse, call the outside lover while they're in the therapy session and break up with them. In short, dump the poor person who evidently has no rights whatsoever. Because that person has to be the villain of the piece if the couple's going to stay together. And I just think that's kind of horrible.
I do, too. I think it's terrible. that person, I mean, and also I think the part of the cheating horror is the feeling that the relationship is supposed to be over. I think there's, I mean, I understand I don't want to be betrayed. I'm big on ethics. But I think that also that sex, we make it into such a huge deal, and that sometimes it was just a case of, you know, like last week, you got the flu, you slept, you know. I wasn't mad because I understand that people are human. We all do these things. That life gets in the way. Mm-hmm. And this overemphasis on the importance of sex, when people have written me, sometimes I think, so you're going to end your whole relationship. It's been wonderful, except for this one time you got drunk and slept with somebody at a hotel. And that's the most important thing. And that's sort of crazy to me.
Yeah, and that happens all the time. And I would also point out then that the poor people who are the outside partners, right?
Yes.
They get treated as if they are just disposable, like they don't count, their feelings don't count, they have no, they're something to get rid of, you know, and I think that's perfectly awful.
Yeah, yeah.
I really want to see a world where we're all welcome, you know, and I don't, you see, much as I don't believe that people should be bullied into opening a relationship, I don't think they should be bullied into monogamy either.
Well, I think that many people don't even consider that they could have a different option. And again, it's not to say that it would work for everyone, but I think that your book shows ways that it might work for some and that it would be ethical and above board and not some kind of creepy thing someone's doing to somebody else, but that things people are doing with, you know, with others, you know, and that maybe can enrich their relationship if they can maybe work through this stuff. I should do a little station ID so we hear about your wonderful book. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in psychology and research. Tonight's brain belongs to therapist Dossie Easton. She, I call, the ethicist of interesting sexual arrangements, and she's the author, a co-author with Janet Hardy, of The Ethical Slut, a practical guide to polyamory, open relationships, and other adventures. Her website is DossieEaston.com. That's DossieEaston.com. And this is a great book because it tells people how to have sexually open relationships in an ethical way, whether they can handle them, how to handle them. And she also even has stuff in this book, I think, that, you know, that you've heard on the show, you know, wisdom for people who don't want open relationships, new ways of thinking about things. Just to get, for the people who might be interested in this, can you talk about finding other partners? Who do you look for to do this with, and where do you find them?
Okay. Of course, I live in San Francisco, which is ground zero for polyamory in a lot of ways, where the Bay Area is.
Yes.
And what I recommend to people, and you can usually start by finding these kind of connections online anywhere you are, but find the polyamory community that's in you. Anybody who's near a big city has a polyamory community available to them. It's there somewhere. You just have to go find it. Because the first thing is that's really helpful is that you find other people who want to be polyamorous too. Because otherwise you're going to go out there, if you go out in, you know, picking people up in bars at random because you like their outfit or something, I don't know. The music's so loud you can't have a conversation, so all you can know is what the person looks like and how they dance, right? And if they can hold their liquor. I got sidetracked, excuse me. but because the assumption in the world is that if you get together with somebody else and you hook up and you actually like that other person, that you are now on a train track to couplehood, right? Well, if you're already coupled to somebody else, that's not going to work very well. And if you walk into a club and you start flirting with people and you're wearing a wedding ring, people are going to, like, take offense.
Right.
It's kind of confusing that. So it helps to find other people who have the same values. Curiously enough, there are plenty of people out there, men and women, who actually like the position of being a secondary or an outside partner and feel very comfortable with this and will even, you know, be sort of an auntie or an uncle to the kids and everything. You know, I mean, it's
what kind of
even part of the family, but would want to be in that relationship, whether it's because they have a primary relationship of their own or because where they are in their life, they're not really desirous of having a primary relationship right now. Or they just like, as Lolita Wolf, a wonderful educator from New York, says, when I'm the secondary partner, I get to be dessert. It's a relationship that can be about playfulness and very lighthearted and be a good friend at the same time, but with the responsibility of not going a lot beyond friendship.
See, this is another thing I like about your work. You bring this up. People don't think about, you know, there's a sort of one volume of relationship. It's on like 96, you know, and some people, for them, it's a 50 volume would be enough. They don't want to live with someone. My boyfriend and I live apart. I think that it keeps your relationship alive to live apart, mm-hmm. you know, but some people, that's just not how you do relationships. But if people who might want to do this or could do this, you know, these are things that they could consider, that they can have, you know, something that's fulfilling sexually and have somebody that they love, but not have to be, you know, married to them and spending their every morning sending the children off to school.
Right.
And I love that creativity.
Yeah. And it could be that an outside partner would come in and say, here, I got you tickets to go to Las Vegas and I'm taking care of the kids.
Yeah. I mean, that'd be amazing. I mean, I think that this is not, I think most people can't get this comfortable with this. We'll talk about that a little bit. We're almost out of time. We have about 4 minutes left. But I wanted mm-hmm. to talk to you about breaking up. You talk about, I love this, how when a traditional marriage breaks up, nobody takes that as evidence that monogamy doesn't work. But people, you know, have that prejudice against these open relationships.
Right. I don't think breakups are any more common among the polyamorous than they are. I dare say the statistics are fairly similar when one, if you match, I don't know how to say this without looking at class, because there are issues of class in here, which gets really, really complicated. Very poor rural families or immigrant families often stay together as a going proposition to get everybody launched into the world. And there are people who are living under a lot of economic necessity. Staying together for the sake of the children means making sure the children go to school or get fed. Not that we fear their emotional wounding if there's a divorce, right?
Yeah.
And those are very different issues, so I think there is kind of an issue in there that people will stay in very difficult relationships when economic necessity requires it. That being said, I think that people who are in relationships that are about emotional satisfaction and gratification, you know, romance is not enough to keep people together for 50 years. It really isn't.
I think that's very wise.
Romance just doesn't work like that. People who stay in marriages that long are people who are staying in marriages for very practical reasons.
Yes.
And they love their partners, but they love them in the same way that I love some of my exes, you know, not in this passionate falling in love infatuation kind of way, but in the solid way of we know each other very, very deeply and we've come to accept each other.
Yeah, but that's not what the mythology says. And I love that you bring out these truths about this. We have 90 seconds left. If we run over a teeny little bit, people who are listening in the chat room, you'll be able to hear that in the podcast. But I want to ask you, do you see how we organize our love and sex lives changing in the future? And if so, how?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we are expanding. I think that we are opening up. I think that we are connecting in a lot of different ways. I think the nuclear family was kind of a mistake to isolate the family like that. And what I see is that relationships and intimate connections and families and even, you know, the children who get cousins from, you know, mommy's lover's kids and so on, that we have a whole new way of creating support systems and networks and basically a big glowing circles of love, you know, in the world. And I think that we can do that. I think that we are doing that. I think that as our economic freedom gives us freedom in mobility and freedom in choosing, you know, what kind of work we do and all kinds of things like that. It also gives us freedom in loving, in making connection and forming family. And then instead of there being one kind of relationship that you have to fit into to be an okay human being, you have this huge choice of discovery, and it might be ideal for you to be this way this year and another way 10 years from now, and that's all fine because you're still building networks of love.
Yeah, I think that very, very interesting creative ideas that you have, and I think more people will begin to live in more creative ways. Dossie Easton, thank you so much for being with us. I just want to talk about your book. It's The Ethical Slut, A Practical Guide to Polyamory, Open Relationships, Other Adventures. It's a terrific book I've been recommending for years. It helps people who want to have sexually open relationships and even people who just want to look at relationships in a new way. Thank you so much, Dossie. You were really terrific.
Thank you, Amy, for welcoming me.